This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Pick up the unfolding story here. You notice up on the screen here this chart related to the different English translations of the Bible. You notice where Tyndale falls on the timeline there of 1525. I mentioned Coverdale, who is going to do a lot of his work on the Old Testament, and he and Tyndale's work together will go to relate to, especially to this great Bible. 1540 is a date associated with that one also. This is the one that I mentioned Cranmer writes an introduction to. Sometimes it's even been called the Cranmer's Bible. The Geneva Bible is an interesting one. This is a little bit later on, but this is the one that's going to be so popular among the Puritans. For 50 years or more, this is going to be the most popular Bible in all of England. And it includes in the margins Calvinist notes. And that's the early Elizabethan Puritan movement is definitely Calvinistic. And Presbyterians are very prominent in that era. But we're going to talk about that a little bit later. Then you've got some other editions all the way down to 1611. We'll pick up and talk about some of these as we go on. But I think that's a helpful chart. But notice, less than 100 years, 9 translations. So a lot of work on the English Bible. And Tyndale's contribution really would set the stage for all Bible translation into English later. All right, let's talk about the infamous Henry VIII. You know, sometimes when you talk about the English Reformation, Bloody Mary or Mary Tudor, his daughter, is kind of held up as this heinous queen that murdered all these people. I would say her father definitely set the tone for his daughter's life, because we'll look at a number of individuals that were close to Henry VIII, and he would lop people's heads off or burn them at the stake for looking at him the wrong way. He was a brutal King of England, and he was a big guy too. One of the funny things last week on the trip, I've seen it before, but just getting to see the a couple of Henry's coats of armor that are made for him. He's not that tall, but he's big. And when you look at the armor, if you look at it sideways, I mean, that guy enjoyed dinner time. He was huge. I've never seen a suit of armor that wide. But I mean, it is just made with his shape for him. But let's talk about him, obviously at the headwaters of what's going to play out in England. I think this is a valid statement as far as it goes to contrast what had happened on the continent with the English Reformation. On the continent, the Reformation began with religion and ended in politics. And if you think about Luther's initial posting of the 95 Theses, his criticism of indulgences, which ends up being very political as it plays out among the princes, the German princes, some of whom are Catholic, some are Protestant. Charles V, you remember our discussion of that and the dilemma that he's in, fighting France and the Turks, and eventually turning his armies against the Protestants. So starting out with basic religious sentiments, but ending up very political in Germany and in the Holy Roman Empire. But on the other side, in the British Isles, certainly with Henry VIII, his obsession to have a male heir drives everything in the initial stages of his serial monogamy. He practiced Hollywood before there was a Hollywood. He would marry and divorce, and here you got a list of his 6 wives. I go on and tell you I'm going to talk about these ladies a little bit and kind of what happened in the story, because it's so integral to the the story of this period. But the best way to remember the future of each one of these ladies is it's divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So if you get confused as we go through that, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. A lady in England told me that one time. I said, you know, that is an easy way to remember that. All right, Catherine of Aragon. Now, he did actually stay married to his first wife for all of 18 years. And this is going to be the catalyst, his relationship with her, for the emergence of the Anglican Church. All right, let's look now at Henry's reform of the church. And we'll start with Catherine of Aragon and then go through the different periods and what happens. Well, Cardinal Wolsey, who was featured in the film, and we've already talked about him, and you saw a picture of his palace, Lord Chancellor of England, and also Cardinal Archbishop of York, very powerful man who was both ambitious and ruthless. And he was giving Henry advice about affairs in England. Henry was very involved in the political sphere of all that was going on in Europe at the time, and the English armies were involved in joining with the King of Spain, who was his father-in-law, Ferdinand, and also with the Pope in the battles against the French to force them out of Italy. And Henry himself had led some successful campaigns in France. And one of the factors that was urging Henry to do some of the things that he did is the coffers in England were getting empty in financing Henry's wars. Henry had visions of English influence and felt like, you know, maybe he will be the great arbiter between Charles V and Francis I, the Habsburg-Valois Wars, which went on in Europe. And Henry had visions of being the one who could bring peace. Well, as things would play out, he desired to have a male heir. His wife, Catherine of Aragon, could not produce a male heir. She had five children, but only one of them survived, a daughter. And this was Mary, Mary Tudor. And Henry desired to marry Anne Boleyn, who was the sister of his favorite mistress and lady-in-waiting to the queen. He became obsessed with her and of wanting to have another spouse so he could have a male heir. Well, an interesting thing had happened to even allow him to marry Catherine of Aragon. She was actually the widow of his brother. And there, in Leviticus chapter 18 and 20, there's some strong words about not taking your brother's wife. He had gotten a special dispensation from the Pope to even marry Catherine of Aragon, but now he's asking for an annulment of this. He's saying that, well, this all took place under false pretenses. You know, as a pastor, I've found this to be true repeatedly. I don't care when couples have trouble and are contemplating divorce, I don't care if they've been married 10, 20, or 30 years. It's always, we know we should have never gotten married. And I won't tell you what I'm really tempted to say when they say that. You can read between the lines, but this is kind of, you know, he's been married to this woman for 18 years. And he said, well, I was kind of deceived in this whole thing anyway. You know, and I just now am discovering this 18 years later. Well, the problem was, guess who Catherine of Aragon's nephew was? Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, the most powerful man in all of Europe. As you would guess, the Pope was pretty much under his thumb. And Catherine pulled rank and said, well, I'm going to appeal to the Pope on this. You may not divorce me. And so you've got a political standoff now where the papacy is being requested to grant an annulment of Henry's marriage. But politically, there's no way the Pope can do that. And besides, it's against the law. Remember, I told you, it's against the law in England to appeal to the papacy without the king's permission. So she has done this, and so a standoff is in place here, and Henry's got this very difficult situation And his advisors are trying to give him a different input on this and how they might be able to figure this out. Well, when the Pope refuses, Henry threatens the Pope with losing England. But the Pope at this time is Clement VII, but he is unmoved by this. Wolsey is actually removed from power. Remember, it's always dangerous to be too close to Henry VIII because he was not able to procure this annulment, so he comes in the king's disfavor. And eventually he is going to be tried for treason en route to the Tower. This is what the king always did, threw you in the Tower of London, which you knew meant I'm awaiting execution in most instances, but he contracted an illness and dies. So Wolsey's the first person to die, although his demise was by natural causes. Because he was not able to secure what the king wanted. Now enter into the story, I call them the three Thomases. And each one is going to be an advisor in a variety of ways to Henry VIII, and each one will basically pay for this with his life eventually. Cranmer, though, is the one who will die under Queen Mary. But to both More and Thomas Cromwell will perish during Henry's reign. Remember, this is not Oliver Cromwell, okay? The English Civil War, that's later, the 17th century. We will talk about Oliver Cromwell, but this is Thomas Cromwell, and he is going to be an important person in the English reform under Henry VIII. Well, Thomas More opposed the divorce from the beginning. Remember, Thomas More was a faithful Catholic, this humanist scholar. He's eventually going to resign his position, protesting what Henry is doing. Henry is going to try to put pressure on Parliament. If I cannot get the Pope to grant a divorce here, then maybe I can get Parliament to come up with some legal maneuvering, because somehow Henry has got to try to give the appearance of this being legal before the English people so that his offspring will be considered the legal inheritors of the throne. So planning to put pressure on the Parliament. Thomas Cranmer actually suggests that Henry appeal to the universities. And Cranmer's idea is, well, why don't you see if the scholars can come up with some way to explain how we can do this. And Cranmer is made the Archbishop of Canterbury, so he's got a very important ecclesiastical position. Now, Thomas Cromwell falls into the equation here. He had served under Wolsey, and he becomes the Vicar General. That means he is the king's chief advisor on church affairs. Now, Thomas Cromwell, was very sympathetic to Lutheran ideas. And so he is advising the king, why don't you follow in the same train as the German princes who have left Rome? We know what's happening in the continent. They have survived and are doing okay. And why don't you do like the German princes did and break off from England? So he's getting this advice, you know. See if you can put pressure on Parliament. Cranmer's saying turn to the universities. Cromwell's encouraging him to do this. Thomas More is resistant. He believes this is wrong, and he is opposed to it, and eventually is going to be moved out of his position and will resign. Well, Cromwell is beginning to suggest to Henry that we need to just cut the Pope out of the equation altogether. And what we really need to see happen in England is to make the church subservient to the crown. Well, any sovereign likes those kind of words. Not only am I head of state, I can be head of the church too. That means I call all the shots. And so Cromwell begins to work through the House of Commons, and legislation is passed not allowing clergy to make any laws in England apart from the House of Commons. And Henry begins to go after some of the clerics who had been appealing to Rome to intervene because this is against the law. And by 1532, an act of submission of the clergy, that they must submit to the king, and again reiterating that all appeals to Rome are illegal. Well, back to our little chart here, Anne Boleyn. He had secretly married her in 1533, and she was pregnant. So now he really is in a fix, because he's got to establish the legitimacy of an heir to secure succession to the throne of England. Well, by this time, the new pope, Paul III. Now, Paul III is going to be very important for our story of the Reformation. We'll look at him in the next unit. He is the pope that calls the Council of Trent into session. Okay? Because, you know, we've been talking about these Protestant movements and separating from the Roman Church, but the Catholics knew there were deep troubles in the church and eventually were going to call a council. Well, it's this very powerful Pope Paul III excommunicates Henry. By 1533, Elizabeth is born. You'll notice on the chart there that her child is Elizabeth, who will eventually reign as queen for 45 years. A very significant part of our drama in England. Well, the first Succession Act is passed in that year, and it becomes treason. This is in 1533. It becomes treason in England not to accept Henry's marriage to Anne. And you know what that means? Anyone who publicly criticizes his new marriage, this is treason. And you know what the punishment for treason is. You lose your head, or you're burned at the stake. Typically, what they did during Henry's reign is the women got beheaded and the men got burned at the stake. That's just kind of the way the pattern went. And right there next to the Tower of London, the White Tower, you can see the green. I was just there last week where many women have lost their heads. And this is what would take place. So he's bringing the hammer down. And by 1534, the infamous Act of Supremacy, where he declares himself the head of the church. The king and his successors are the head of the Anglicana Ecclesia. Now, this particular viewpoint of ecclesiology is known as Erastianism. And let me put this chart up here. I think we've looked at this chart before to remind you where we are. Remember, one of the distinctives among the different branches of the Protestant church in the 16th century are the differing perspectives they have on church government. Luther, you recall, had worked very closely with the princes, but had advocated a certain amount of independence of the clergy, but still very much a part of what we call that the magisterial reformer mindset. You must work in conjunction with the state. Calvin had argued for even more independence. Remember, we talked about his standoff with the city council, where the city council had tried to intervene on deciding who can and cannot come to communion. And Calvin said, absolutely not. That's the determination of the pastors, and you don't have anything to do with it. And he finally got his way there in Geneva. So even more independence or separation from the church. Calvin's perspective that the church should influence decisions of the state, but the civil magistrates have got to, is a separate sphere and have got to make decisions. Now remember the Anabaptists, they didn't want to have anything to do with the state. As we describe the different views, as Niebuhr describes it, of a Christ against culture idea, and felt like it was sinful even for you to serve in public office. Well, in the Anglican position, as it developed under Henry VIII, identified with the name Erastus. Erastus was a Swiss jurist who had to put forward this theory that the kings, the head of state, should also be the head of the church. So it's kind of on the other end of the spectrum. And essentially what it's doing, you remember my old drawer imagery? Remember what I said? Again, a gross oversimplification, but basically what Henry wanted to do, he left 90% of the traditions in the drawer. This is the way he wanted to see the Church of England, but he took out the Pope and he put himself in. I am the head of the church. And he wanted the church to maintain traditional Catholic theology and practice for the most part. He had some give and take with some of the Protestants on some of it. Not a whole lot. And we'll talk about how that is going to have an ebb and flow to it. But the Anglican position was basically to make the king the head of the church. Well, Thomas More, we mentioned him of the three Thomases. He is the one who's more strongly Roman Catholic. Cranmer has been influenced by Zwinglianism, by Luther's writings. He's influenced by some of the Calvinists that will make their way to England. So he's kind of an eclectic in terms of the influence on them. And Cromwell, Lutheran sympathizer, but More was staunchly Roman Catholic, and he resisted Henry's attempts to break away. He did not accept the divorce, and he is eventually going to be beheaded in 1535, and is he got the more merciful treatment. Maybe Henry felt like he was being kind to him because they had been close friends at one point, because usually the men got the stake, but he did behead More. But part of his rationale for doing that is to make a statement, because what he did, they stuck his head on a pike and displayed it on the bridge, the Tower Bridge in London, for quite a while, just to make a statement. Anybody who opposes the king's new act of supremacy, this is what's going to end up, because this is within the next year. Well, in Roman Catholic lore, he is a great martyr and a saint, eventually canonized in Roman Catholic theology, not until the early 20th century, but Sir Thomas More. So at least even on the Catholic side, some are resisting him. Well, remember I told you Henry's involved with the wars with France. His treasury is seriously depleted, and guess what Cromwell comes up with? An idea, and this is kind of a mixed motive, but not only to increase his income, but also to suppress Catholicism, because the heart of Catholicism in England, as it was in so much of Europe, was the power base was in the monasteries. And a lot of the monasteries were associated with the great churches and cathedrals. And you see from this diagram how many monasteries there were all over England. And the suppression of the monasteries beginning in 1536, he started with the smaller ones. There were over 200 small monasteries, which overnight, all of this property was confiscated by the crown. They ran the monks out. There was legislation requiring some of the monks to get married, to disavow their vows of celibacy. Some of the abbots in the monasteries were executed. They went in and took into the treasury of these monasteries, sold off these goods, sold off some of the land. Henry gave the land. And overnight, the income of the sovereign of England doubled through all of this land that he took over. Well, the Catholics in England were hopping mad about this, and it started a rebellion. But you need to have in mind, even with the criticism of the church, we're talking about the end of the medieval era, these are traditional Roman Catholic Englishmen. And all of a sudden you're running the popes out, I mean the priests and the monks, and confiscating all this property. And there was a rebellion. It was known as the Pilgrimage of Grace. And Henry crushed it, and over 200 people were hung publicly. These rebels were executed. And Thomas Cromwell was hated throughout England because it was known that he was behind encouraging Henry's dissolution of the monasteries. Sometimes it's called the suppression of the monasteries. And this is a watershed moment in England. Well, Cranmer is going to play an important role now, very close to the king. I've often amazed. Cranmer was shrewd enough to know where he needed to bend and where, you know, he could voice criticism. But how he survived Henry's reign without, you know, losing his life, I'll never know. But Cranmer had the king's ear, and as they began to now think through what this new animal called the Anglican Church is going to look like. And as Anglicanism emerges, there are some competing parties, and Henry's well aware of this. You've got the Henricans, which are going to try to steer somewhat of a middle course, the middle way, which England becomes known. It's not going to fully be fleshed out until the time of Elizabeth. But Henry's trying to steer a course between progressives personified in folks like Cromwell and Cranmer, who are very inclined to Protestant Lutheran ideas with those Englishmen who were all in favor of separating from Rome, but were still very Roman Catholic in theology and practice. And so he is trying to steer this middle course, certainly asserting the divine right of kings, that he has the absolute say-so in church and state. But Cranmer's role becomes very significant. The Ten Articles Act are issued in 1536, and some significant compromise in the language that is stated there in this Ten Articles Act. Here's some of the things, and it sounded very Lutheran. You see Cranmer and Cromwell's influence. In fact, he had tried to take advantage of some of the Lutheran documents, such as the Wittenberg Articles, sound very similar to these Ten Articles of 1536. And like the early Luther, the Ten Articles talked about acknowledging only three sacraments in the same way Luther had spoken as early as the Babylonian captivity of the church: baptism, Eucharist, and penance. So the Ten Articles Act, on the surface, was very Lutheran. Talked about how saints should be honored but not adored like God. Prayers for the dead were retained, but the word purgatory was deleted. So you can see making some concessions to both Catholics and also those with Protestant sensitivities. The real presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper is affirmed, but without spelling out explicitly the mode. Justification by faith is affirmed, but so is the necessity of good works for salvation. They actually borrowed some of the language from Melanchthon. I don't know if you remember, I mentioned that Melanchthon had had his conversations with some of the Catholic scholars, and they had worked out some statements. So borrowing definitely from the Lutheran Reform in this Ten Articles. Well, something called the Bishop's Book in 1537 was also written, designed for study by the clergy to get them to on board with these new reforms. So a compromise between these Protestants and also more Catholic sensitivities. Cranmer's promoting the English Bible. It's about this time that the Great Bible is going to come to the surface, and Cranmer is going to put that forward in encouraging the Bible to be read by all Englishmen. One thing I'll say about Cranmer, even at this point, and toward the end of his life, as would happen with a number of the martyrs, their particular view on the Lord's Supper is what will be their demise. Because transubstantiation, the doctrine of the Mass, is a re-sacrifice of Christ, were set in stone in traditional Roman Catholic theology. Cranmer, I thought to myself, may be the one of the more honest men of the 16th century, because he changed his viewpoints on the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper at least three times. But toward the end of his life, he takes his stand. He had been influenced by Zwingli. He had read Lutheran teaching. He availed himself of more Calvinist understanding of the spiritual presence of Christ. And you can kind of follow his career and how the language in the Book of Common Prayer would be modified and understood. So Cranmer had to deal with that very sticky problem of trying to define the presence of Christ in the Lord's Supper, which had been so divisive on the continent, all the way back to Zwingli and Luther's showdown at Marburg, not being able to come to some conclusions there. But Cranmer's going to try to advocate more a middle course through there. All right, to James Seymour. Anne Boleyn, we find out that she is convicted of adultery, and she is beheaded in 1536. Henry now is going to marry Jane Seymour. And Jane seemed to be a little more sympathetic to the Protestant theology. It's interesting to observe that. Her brother eventually is going to be a very prominent individual in England after Henry VIII died, but Jane will die from complications in childbirth, but she gives birth to his male heir that he so desperately wanted, little King Edward. And little King Edward is going to become the King of England at 9 years old, and he will die at 16. So he is only going to be king for 7 years. But those 7 years are the high point of Protestantism in the first half of the 16th century in England. But we'll get to that story. But Jane Seymour dies. And at this point, we can bring Thomas Cromwell back into the story. Remember, he had been very enamored with the Lutherans, and he had gone out. You know, the King of England's got to have a wife, and now his third wife has perished in childbirth, and the little Edward's going to need somebody to look after him. And so he goes out and negotiates with one of the German princes. Aha, this is the way I can sneak in, you know, a stronger Lutheran influence in England. He gets a Protestant princess, if you would, to come and agree to marry the king, Anne of Cleves. But apparently Anne, bless her soul, was not very attractive. Henry referred to her as that Flemish mare. And he said, there ain't no way I'm going to marry that woman. So he got a divorce before they ever got married, basically, which put Thomas Cromwell in a horrible position. He was mortified. Now, he had negotiated with a German prince, you know, for this wedding, and Henry won't do it, and he's not going to marry the woman. So Cromwell is also loses his life. He is beheaded for charges of heresy and treason, and so he meets his demise also. So Anne of Cleves doesn't work out, and now Catherine Howard is brought forward. She is the niece of the Duke of Norfolk. He's of more conservative ilk, more Roman Catholic in his background and position. And the king asked the Duke of Norfolk to present Parliament with 6 articles. And this shows you how Henry's kind of vacillating. You know, Cranmer's influence. But the 6 articles... after now, Protestants had been encouraged that the king's broken away from the papacy, and we're going to slowly but surely see Protestantism tolerated and become the prominent position in England. But the king now issues the 6 articles, which became known among the Protestants as a whip with 6 bloody strings, because it was against the law to controvert these 6 teachings: death by burning, your property could be seized, 500 Protestants are arrested, some become martyrs. Cranmer, though, miraculously is not removed, even though he publicly criticizes the 6 articles. But one of the things he had to do, you'll notice number 3, the celibacy of the clergy. Cranmer had married. He had to send his wife off to Germany. And he finally agrees to go along with that. I thought, just to for you have a sense of where the Reformation was at this point, I'm going to read to you the substance of the 6 articles. Here are the main points. Now, it's a longer document. After it lists the 6 points, it goes into greater detail. And it's primarily focused on practice, not so much theology, although your practice flows from your theology, we all know. But let me just read to you the substance of these 6 articles, and I'm reading from the document itself. And you can follow along and you'll see these 6 points made here. First, that in the most blessed sacrament of the altar, by the strength and efficacy of Christ's mighty word, it being spoken by the priest, is present really, under the form of bread and wine, the natural body and blood of our Savior Jesus Christ, conceived of the Virgin Mary, and that after the consecration there remaineth no substance of bread and wine, nor any other substance but the substance of Christ, God, and man. All right, now this is a reversal, you know, of the 10 articles. Remember I said the 10 articles initially was kind of non-committal. I mean, this is bona fide transubstantiation. There's no doubt about it. Secondly, that communion in both kinds is not necessary to salvation by the law of God to all persons, that it is to be believed and not doubted of, but that in the flesh and under the form of bread is the very blood, and with the blood under the form of wine is the very flesh, as well apart as though they were both together. So he's affirming the old practice of only offering the people the bread and not the cup. communion only in one kind, which, you remember, Luther had spoken out, and all the reformers up to this period had been against. The people should receive both. Number three, that priests, after the order of priesthood received as a form, may not marry by the law of God. Fourthly, the vows of chastity or widowhood by man or woman made to God advisedly ought to be observed by the law of God, and that it exempts them from other liberties of Christian people which without they might enjoy. Fifthly, that it is meet and necessary that private masses be continued and admitted in this the King's English Church and congregation, is whereby good Christian people, ordering themselves accordingly, do receive both godly and goodly consolations and benefits, and it is agreeable also to God's law. And then sixthly, that auricular confession is expedient and necessary to be retained and continued used and frequented in the Church of God. Auricular means to the ear. It means to the ear of the priest, that once a year there must be an annual confession to the priest. Well, as you can tell, this is very Roman Catholic, isn't it? And so Henry is edging away a bit back toward, not toward the papacy and reuniting with the Catholicism, but in terms of what he wants to see this new creature called the Anglican Church be. He's basically wanting it to maintain Catholic theology, but be under the king rather than the pope. This is Henry's desire. So he gets Norfolk to write this. The king puts his imprimatur on it. And for the Protestants, a whip with six bloody strings, and up to 500 were arrested and many of those killed. So it became very serious business to cross the King of England on this. Well, Catherine Howard is convicted of adultery both before and after the wedding. And so she loses her life. And finally, he marries Catherine Parr, this lady who takes care of Henry in his old age, and she did survive King Henry VIII. Well, at the end of his life, again, gives you a little glimpse of where he was in terms of his own Catholic, Roman Catholic convictions. He issues the King's Book in 1543, kind of a last will and testament, if you would. He dies in 1547, but here, just a few years before he dies, and here he reaffirms the seven sacraments of the church. Remember the 10 articles they talked about in a very Lutheran sense, only three? So Henry goes back and says, no, the seven sacraments of the church are what I believe. Well, he dies in 1547, and who comes to the throne but the little boy, 9-year-old son, Jane Seymour's boy, Edward VI, and it's kind of a hard to grasp, but what Henry did before he died in his later hours, he appointed this council of advisors for Edward, because he knew since Edward, even though he was younger than his sisters, he was the male heir. And so he is going to be the one to succeed his father. But Henry actually appoints a council of rather conservative Protestant counselors. How about that? And that was a good thing for the Protestants, this council of regency. And you can see in the picture Henry pointing to his son, and you've got some of the Protestant advisors there, the regents. But Henry himself in his will leaves provision that many, many masses will be said for his soul. That is, as he understood it, would be in purgatory. So, but yet leaves part of his legacy, leaving these Protestant advisors for his son. All right, Edward VI then ascends to the throne and in 1547. So you see a very short reign for this young lad. Well, Edward Seymour, this is Jane Seymour's brother. The Duke of Somerset becomes Lord Protector. So he's really the power before the throne, and for all practical purposes, he is implementing the power of the throne in England. Now, toward the last years of his life, John Dudley, the Earl of Warwick, will become Protector, because Somerset kind of falls out of favor with some of the other advisors. But Somerset and Warwick, both of Protestant sympathies now are able to move the Protestant ideas down the track, if you would, within the Church of England, the real rulers behind the throne. Cranmer's influence plays a big part now, and Protestantism is going to prosper. In fact, if you look at the chart on the left-hand side, if we were to characterize Henry VIII's reform of the Church of England as he initiates the Anglican movement, to categorize it as Reformed Catholicism because of his own traditional theology. But now under Edward VI, the Reformed influence is going to play a big part. And as he advanced Protestantism, and some very well-known people, at least known to us in our Reformed circles, are going to make their way to England during the time of Edward VI. And this is where you're going to have the input, which in many ways makes the Anglican church, even to this day, although many Anglicans have moved away from it, Calvinistic. I mean, the statement in the 39 Articles on predestination is just, it's shorter, but it's just as strong as any statement you find in the Puritan, you know, Westminster documents, or that you'd find in Calvin's Institutes. The view of the Lord's Supper tends to reflect a Calvinistic influence. And so Cranmer and the Reformed tradition are going to play a part during this little window of Edward VI in a way that they would not later on. So, what begins to happen is the hand of time is rolled back. And Edward VI, under Somerset and his Protestant advisors, now began to turn back some of the movements that Henry had initiated. Repealing the Six Articles. Remember, this was the statement I just read to you that was very Catholic. It allowed for the unrestricted printing of the English Bible, the proliferation of the scriptures in England during Edward VI is quite amazing. The influence of both the Lutheran and Calvinistic ideas in England are going to be more and more advanced. Some of Cranmer's writings are going to be spread throughout England, the English Bible available in all the churches, and the stream of refugees from the continent begin to come to England. Because by this time, Charles V is repressing Protestants in Europe, so is Francis. We've talked about what played out there in France and the Huguenots. But most of the refugees now that come to England are of Zwinglian or Calvinist persuasion. Some of them would be individuals like Martin Bucer. Remember, Bucer is the one in Strasbourg who had been a mentor for John Calvin. And Calvin, the first time he essentially was kicked out of Geneva, had gone and spent several years with Bucer. Bucer, during some of the pressure coming from Charles V, flees to England. Comes at Cranmer's invitation and will be a Regius professor at Cambridge. In fact, you go on the campus of Cambridge to the great St. Mary's Church there, and up by the altar, there's a plaque there in where the Martin Bucer was buried there on the on those grounds. But as far as his remains, we really don't have them because, as was typical in these days during the time of Mary Tudor, they dug up his remains and burned them, and just to show disdain for these Protestants. But there still is a plaque there at Great St. Mary's on the campus of Cambridge that Martin Bucer was a professor there. Remember I said Cambridge was a hotbed of Protestantism during these years. So Bucer was there. Peter Martyr Vermigli, this was an Italian reformer. Dr. James on our Orlando campus is a real expert in Peter Martyr, if you're ever interested. And he comes from an Italian family that had been critical of the church. And he had read Bucer and others and had come to Protestant ideas. He also is going to teach in England during the time of Edward VI. He will be at Oxford And John Knox from Scotland also comes to England. And Knox will actually become a chaplain to Edward VI. So John Knox, the great Scottish reformer, spends a few years in England himself. The only people, and this was rather typical, the only people who weren't welcome in Edward VI's England were the Anabaptists. All other Protestants, please come see us. You're welcome in England. So this is quite a shift. And so the continental Protestantism is going to have a place at the table in England, and those ideas will interact with this emerging Anglican theology. Well, the Edwardian bishops had quite a broad spectrum of perspectives, because you have to remember this transition is happening piecemeal. It's not like everybody woke up all of a sudden and, you know, eureka. They're all Lutherans or all Calvinists overnight. So quite a spectrum. And on the issue of the presence of Christ, you had some of the bishops in England were all the way over where Zwingli's view, a more memorial understanding of the presence of Christ. Some of the bishops in England still embrace transubstantiation. So wide spectrum theologically in England while Edward is king. So I don't want you to have the idea of homogeneity in England at this time yet. Certainly not. Well, the first prayer book, and this is probably Cranmer's lasting legacy, and forever associated with that great piece of English literature, and which is so beloved not only in the Anglican circles, but to many Protestants appreciate the prayers and the liturgy, and even non-Anglican churches like to use parts of the Book of Common Prayer. 1549, formed under Cranmer. Now, part of what's happening, if you can just envision in your mind, we're going to take a break here a second. Let me just complete this thought for you. If you can just envision what Edward VI and his Protestant advisors were now looking out on. We've broken away from England. We've got a lot of people that still maintain Catholic practices. Out in the parishes, there's now a spirit of more openness, and you have a lot of different liturgical practices going on. The traditional Roman Catholic Mass, to some of the priests who'd come to Zwinglian ideas. I mean, the practice of the faith in England was all over the place. Well, sovereigns are always concerned about uniformity, because one of the ways you keep your hand on the people is you by enforcing uniformity to a certain degree. And so the idea was, let's come up with a liturgy that everyone in England can be under. And as the Book of Common Prayer has been described as a studied piece of ambiguity, the language, you can appreciate that. Our Anglican brother, I saw a big smile on his face. But you have to remember the context. What Cranmer and Edward VI and his advisors were interested in doing was having language in there that traditionalists and Roman Catholics, that it was very liturgical. In fact, most of us who are Protestant types, and I found this on the trip, we went to Evensong in York Minster, which was an awesome experience. I couldn't help thinking, as I turned and faced the altar and I'm reciting the Apostles' Creed, how many of God's people, for how many centuries, have stood in that building and recited the Apostles' Creed? I mean, it was a very meaningful experience. But a lot of the folks on the trip, you know, this was the first time they had been in traditional Anglican liturgy, and they felt like they were in a Roman Catholic worship service. And I'd remind them, this is purposeful to a certain extent. The liturgy was such that the language is very Protestant in so many ways, in its use of Scripture, but it has the feel, in many ways, of traditional Catholic liturgy. This is a part of the genius of it, as far as Cranmer was concerned. Now, it's been modified, and that's part of the debate ongoing among the Anglicans about the different modifications and which version of the prayer book you like. But at least from the very beginning, the idea was to try to find something that would be good for all of England. Well, services of are now going to be completely in English in all the churches. That is one of the major contributions now, so that the English people have the liturgy now in their own language. So the Protestant Mass in the liturgy in Latin is gone, and now it's a completely complete English liturgy. And that's the significant place that the Book of Common Prayer has in the history of the English Reformation.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.